It's about 4:30, so I think I'm going to go ahead and start. Can you hear me okay? Okay. Good afternoon. My name is Tracy Williams, and I'm a trainer for Wanda Senseri's program, Spell to Write and Read. My topic is classical phonics, as you can see. So one of my goals is to show you how this program fits with classical methodology. But as I read up on the origin and the research behind this program, I learned how crucial it is to use phonics to teach children to read. And most of you would probably agree with that. But I also learned that many of the programs out there which profess to be phonics-based actually are not, or at the very least are just a weak facsimile of phonics. So I'd actually like to change my topic to recovering the lost tools of phonics. I thought that fit well with this kind of a conference. And I hope to show you why I feel like we need to do that. I want to tell you a little bit about myself before we get started. My husband and I were part of a group of parents that started a classical Christian school in the Maryland, Delaware area back in 1994. Prior to that, we homeschooled our children. And I remember when we made that decision to homeschool, my biggest fear was, I don't know how to teach my children to read. And so I began looking at different programs, and I tried a couple different programs. And I was not happy with the disconnect between spelling and reading and handwriting. I wasn't sure why I wasn't happy with that disconnect, but I learned later why. I took a class of this program and realized that this program integrated and combined all of those and some more. So it not only combined reading and spelling and handwriting, it combined some grammar and some basic composition. And so I went home immediately and started teaching it to my children. I eventually started training others. And then my major goal was to train. Once we started the school, I wanted this program to be used in our school. And so I trained the teachers in our school. So my goals today are to give an overview of this curriculum, demonstrate how it's actually used, and show how well it fits with the classical model. I have to tell you, though, that that's a bit of an ambitious undertaking, because usually when I teach this, I do it in two full days, and it really could use a third day. I could teach this in that much time, because this program actually accomplishes teaching spelling up through a 12th grade level. Now, we normally do that by the fifth grade. So my dilemma today is to show you the comprehensiveness of this program in a 50-minute time slot without overwhelming you and making it seem impossible. So I need you to realize that this information, and I'm just going to give you a taste of it really today, is taught in a spiral fashion over 6 to 7 years. And what I mean by that is that every year you come back and revisit the same basic principles and rules, and you add to it. You add more complex words and more complex rules, much the same way you teach math. You start out as something, but every year you review those principles. So you need to realize that that's what I'm doing. Now, my outline is on page 118 of your books. And I will basically follow that. But I want to tell you basically how this is going to go. I'm going to talk about the history and the research that goes into this program. It's going to take me a few minutes to get into that. And then I'm going to tell you what I think are the distinctives and the strengths, what makes this program different than other programs out there, because there's a lot of phonics programs out there. Then I'm going to demonstrate to you the basic, what I would do basically in beginning this program with a student. And then I want to try and show you some of the more advanced rules or concepts that I would teach. But first, I need to give you a little bit of the history. And actually, how it came about gives a very compelling argument for its use. It's based on the Spalding method. Some of you may be familiar with that. But back during the 20s and 30s, and actually before that in the 1800s, during what they called the progressive school movement, which has lasted up until today and obviously is not as progressive as they thought, Horace Mann, and he was actually in the 1800s, not in the 20s and the 30s, Horace Mann decided that children needed to learn to read for meaning. Now, that doesn't sound like a bad idea at all, does it? But what he thought was that they didn't need to learn the rote drill of the parts of a word. They just needed to look at a word and recognize it. And that way, they would get the full meaning of the word. And interestingly, he got his ideas from Thomas Gallaudet. And I don't know if you're familiar with him, but he is the man that began teaching deaf children to read with sign language. And that made sense, because children that are deaf come to reading with no language. So to teach them a sign as the meaning of a word makes sense. But children who come with hearing, with normal hearing, come with a vocabulary in the thousands of words. And so he kind of missed that step. And Thomas Gallaudet actually thought it was a good idea and actually changed his mind in later years. But so the look say, or the whole word method, was born. And Horace Mann introduced it into schools in Boston, and they used it for a number of years. And at first they liked it. But they found after several years, the children didn't progress. In other words, they learned some sight words. They did learn to read from sight words, but they reached a point where they stalled. And so the Boston school teachers drew up a resolution rejecting using this method. And Horace Mann defended it, and they rejected it again. And they did quit using it in the Boston schools. But it made its way into different philosophies, and it eventually was resurrected again in the 20s and the 30s. Now, you could say, and it has lasted up till now. I mean, school systems still teach with this method. I don't know if you recognize the picture of the book there. It's the Dick and Jane books. Did any of you learn to read with Dick and Jane? I did too. And it was in a Catholic school where I learned, where I would assume phonics would have been taught. Anyway, you could say that Horace Mann and the advocates of the look, say, or whole word approach confused two processes. They confused learning to read with reading to learn. And it is true that words need to become automatic for a student to be able to read with for meaning and with comprehension. But getting to that point is where he went wrong. Think about this. When you memorize a word, when you learn it by sight, you memorize the configuration of it. A student can look left to right. They can look right to left. They can look at what letter begins the word, what letter ends the word, how many are in the middle. You can see where reversals and so-called dyslexic symptoms would arise from that, simply using that method to learn to read. Well, it took hold anyway. And publishing companies produced curriculum. Schools bought into it, made the investment, and it was very difficult to let this go, and they still haven't let it go to this day. Now, Dr. Samuel Orton was a neurologist back in the 20s and 30s, and he actually worked with brain-damaged adults, but worked his way into this and saw the damage that using this method to teach to read was causing, and he warned against it. And he actually worked with a group of people to develop a program to remediate the problems that this particular method of teaching reading was causing. And I have a quote up here. Got to remember to point at my computer. By Anna Gillingham. So Anna Gillingham worked with Dr. Orton. And this is what she says. You can read it with me. Late in the 19th century, there came a return to the ancient ideogrammatic concept. I like to think of it as hieroglyphics. A word was to be learned in its totality as an ideogram, disregarding the letters of which it was composed. In the extreme form of this method, the letters are not learned at all. This sight word approach swept over America and has worked havoc with reading and spelling. So Anna Gillingham recognized as well, a lot of people recognized the problems that this was causing in teaching children to read. Now, so I have listed here four people that I think were very influential in the origin of this program. Orton actually coined the term dyslexia, and he said it needed to be a multisensory approach to integrate both sides of the brain. Anna Gillingham took the sounds of English. There are about 45 sounds in the English language, and she categorized them into 70 basic ways to spell them. We call those phonograms. Phono means sound, gram means written. So a phonogram is the written representation of a sound. And she came up with about 70 basic ways to do that. Romualda Spaulding was actually one of the last people to work with Dr. Orton. And she felt like her method, or what she came up with, was the conclusions of his research. And she took his program and developed it for the classroom. And so she used it with students. But what she found was that the students in her so-called disabled class actually progressed faster and farther than their counterparts in the normal class. And so she thought, well, if this actually remediates, why not use it from the beginning and prevent? She actually had parents and students coming to her and saying, can't we be in your class? Can't my son or daughter be in your class? And so she took this information and wrote the book, The Writing Road to Reading, where she laid out all of the theory and the research and the ideas, but she didn't put it in a sequential order. She trained teachers to do that, but she didn't do it herself. She just had this book of all these ideas. Wanda Censeri, who's the author of this program, actually trained under Mrs. Spaulding, and she took the program and expanded it, added to it, and put it in a manual that tells you, you do this first, you do this second, you do this third, and she gave an order to it. So, now, I put this up here for a reason. Because I want you to see what it's like to read with some sight words in there. Read this and tell me, did it slow you down? Did you have to stop and think? That's what sight words are about. I don't know if you've ever had students that have used this approach and they come to you and they're not reading well and you listen to them read and it's halting. Because they come to a word that they don't have memorized and they have to literally attack it. You've heard of word attack? They literally have to attack it to figure it out. And so by the time they get it, I mean, when I looked at this the first time, I had to read it twice. I had to first get what it was, and then I had to go back and figure out what it meant. And that's what happens when children learn by sight. Now, so why did I go into all this? And why is it important? Well, I think it's safe to say that most teachers involved in classical education understand the importance of a phonics approach to teaching reading versus whole language or sight words. But just as we are recovering the lost tools in other areas of education, I'd like to suggest we're recovering them in this area as well. In other words, because so many of us were not taught with phonics, we don't recognize true phonics. We don't know what it is anymore. And so we end up marrying phonics with sight word because that's what we're familiar with, and we get this hybrid. And you know what? The hybrid doesn't work any better than the pure form of it. And I've seen this in my experience with students. Do you ever get students that they read and they guess at words? That for the word the, they'll say for? Well, they're both three-letter words. You know, they both begin with a tall letter. And I couldn't figure this out. And that's what's happened is they've latched on to this sight word method. And that's how they proceed. They guess at the words. So what I want to show you is a method that eliminates sight words. So I don't know how many of you are teaching a phonics program with sight words in it. But it's not necessary. And I would go so far as to say it's dangerous, because you're going to get some groups of kids that learn with that, but you're going to get other groups that latch on to it and don't progress to where they need to go. All right. So I'm going to first, before I demonstrate this, I want to talk to you about the distinctives. And first, we need to talk about the challenge that we face. First of all, English is a rich language. It's the biggest language in the world. In the modern Chinese dictionary, there are 12,000 entries. French has about 100,000 words. But the Oxford English Dictionary has 500,000 plus words. It's impossible to memorize, for the brain to memorize that many words by a visual means alone. Our code is complex as well, although I would argue that this program makes it less complex. How many times have you heard that English is the most difficult language to learn? Well, I think it's the most difficult language for people because they've learned by sight, and they don't have these tools that I'm hoping to give you. We have 26 letters, about 45 sounds in English, and about 70 basic ways to spell those sounds. Now, given the complexity, you can see why it's impossible to memorize all of the words as the whole language or look-say approach requires. In fact, research shows that the human mind can only memorize about 1,500 to 2,000 abstract visual symbols. So given the scope of the problem, the challenge, what makes this program the best? So let's go ahead, and I'm going to go through with you what I think are the biggest distinctives and strengths of this program. Now, it's streamlined. And this is actually a quote from The Writing Road to Reading. So listen to what Romualda Spalding says. This is then the core reading subskill. You have to learn which letters represent which phonemes in English. You do not have to learn every single letter sound unit, but you need a substantial working set. In other words, we have 70 basic phonograms. There's more than that. But once a student learns that that's how our language works, that letters or groups of letters make sounds, it's not a far stretch for them to look at a phonogram that maybe they haven't seen yet and say, oh, right, that pair of letters makes this sound. They literally learn to look at words in a different way. In every complex skill, there is a similar working set of basic units that have to be learned. I always go back to math. If you don't learn those math facts, you're doomed when you get up into algebra, into higher levels of math, out of which higher order units can then be constructed. We can call the working set of letter phoneme units the first order skills of literacy. So that's the basis of this program. Now, I want to say, I'm going to go back to that for just a second. We're dealing with the grammar stage. And in Doug Wilson's book, The Case for Classical Christian Education, he defines what the grammar stage is. And I'm going to quote it a little bit. I'm not going to do the whole quote. Grammar is not simply linguistic, but should be understood as the constituent parts of each subject. In the study of language, of course, grammar has to do with verbs, nouns, direct objects, and the occasional exclamation. The grammar of history would be timelines, names, dates, and battles. But someone may have taken all sorts of these facts on board and still not be educated. At the same time, attempting to go on to other levels of the trivium without this foundation is also disastrous. And I would add to this that without good reading, writing, and spelling skills, all of these others are impossible. Children need to learn to read so they can read to learn. And if it's done badly, because you can accomplish some things with the look-say method, the rest will end badly. The colleges today have had to dumb down what they teach because students don't have those basic skills. They have to remediate them when they get to college. So there's a study that's been done, and this is interesting, I think, that shows that one-third of students will learn to read with whatever you put before them. Even look, say, whole word, they will learn to read. Another third will learn if you do some very direct, intensive instruction. But then the final third, for them, it is one of the most difficult things they will ever learn to do. Now, do you know which category those kids fit into when they come to your class? I don't think we do. I think it becomes apparent over time, but I don't think you can tell that when they come in, because really, what happened after the look, say, whole word method started being implemented, there arose this whole group of people with average to above average intelligence who simply were not learning to read. And so we need to use this method to overcome those problems. So what we do is we teach the 70 basic ways to spell the 45 sounds in English. We teach them the 70 phonograms. Next, we teach them that sounds combine to make words. After that, we show them, we take those spelling words that they've learned and we use rules, there's 28 altogether, to show them how to make derivatives of those words. Then they learn to combine those words into sentences and eventually sentences into paragraphs and compositions. And at the end of it, they're not limited to a controlled vocabulary in a basal reader. They're able to handle anything. And I'll show you, when we teach the phonograms, normally when you teach an A in a particular program, you say it, you teach it says A. But an A can really say three different things. It can say A, it can say A, it can say A. Now, when you don't give them that information, they're stuck when they get to a word with a long vowel sound or a word where the A says ah. But if you give them all that information from the beginning and then start to slowly show them how you figure out which sound it makes, they have all the tools they need to read. They're not limited anymore. So that's what we're going to do. We're going to teach them the grammar of spelling, reading, and writing. Now, another distinctive is our spelling list. Once the students have learned the phonograms, we start applying them to words. Now, one of the things that I wondered when I first started teaching my own children was, how did they come up with these words in these spelling lists? You know, what made them decide to put these lists together? Oftentimes, it was because there was a particular spelling with them. They used a particular set of letters in it. Maybe the first letter and the last letter was different, but the middle letters were the same. Well, we don't do that. And because then it's a no-brainer when it comes to the spelling test. We use the Leonard Ayers list. And Leonard Ayers was a man who, before the use of computers, this is astounding to me, he managed to compile a list of the most frequently used words in the English language, and then he ordered them according to spelling difficulty. So he had to do this by going through books and counting how many times particular words were used. That's astounding to me. And he was pretty much right. Not too much of that needed to be corrected. So we have a list, and Wanda Sinceri took his list and added some words to it, and she corrected some of the mistakes based on what computers tell us, and she added some words to show all the patterns of spelling that they're going to face, and came up with 2,000 words, which comprises about 85% of all we read and write. So when they are finished this list, that's how much they have learned to read and to spell and to write. And we use, it's a spiral approach. Like I said, every year we go back to the beginning. We go back and we review the phonograms. We review the rules, but we just keep taking them higher and higher in the list. And by the fifth or sixth grade, by the end of the list, they are at about a 12th grade spelling level. And it isn't organized according to sound, so they have to think about what they're doing when they spell words. We also teach spelling first. Now, most programs start with reading, but we start with spelling. When you think about it, reading and spelling are actually a reversible code. Just like addition is the reverse of subtraction and multiplication is the reverse of division, spelling is the reverse of reading. And so in reading, you blend sounds together to form a word. With spelling, you take it apart. You unglue it to figure out which sounds are part of the word. And think about this. How many of you, well, probably some of you can even attest to this. How many of you can read very well, but you can't spell worth a lick? I talk to people all the time that say that. But very seldom do you have someone who spells really well who isn't also a good reader. And so we start with spelling. Students naturally learn to read. There's never a time when you sit and teach them to read other than they sound out the words that they're learning to spell. And they just naturally, some of them do it quicker than others, but they all end up at the same place. Now, what they end up doing is they compile their words in a notebook. So they actually accumulate a list of hundreds of words for which the spelling has been worked out and practiced repeatedly. So each student would have a notebook each year, and each year the words would get further up in the list, would get harder. We also have a marking system, which is, if you observe this in a classroom, you would think it was Greek. But what they do is they analyze the words when they're done as to why they're spelled the way they are. And there's about 5 markings that they do, and you would be amazed at how quickly students learn how to mark words. Then, when they've learned these marking conventions, actually analyzing a word becomes like a problem-solving seminar, and they're all like jumping to see if they can come up first with how to mark the word. So I'll show you that when I demonstrate to you how I dictate a word. It's multisensory. I think most educators understand that everyone has a different learning style. And it's usually a combination, but there's usually one learning style that's stronger than the rest. And when you teach so that all the learning styles are covered, you engage all of your students and you create stronger pathways in the brain. Now, when I was in college, before I knew anything about learning styles, I remember I could never miss a lecture. I had to go to every lecture. There were those kids that would come and get the syllabus and never show up till the exams. But I always had to hear the lecture. And when I studied, I recopied my notes, I condensed them, recopied them, and read them aloud to myself to get the information to stick. Well, it's using those 4 of the 5. The only thing we don't do is smell it. We see it, hear it, say it, and write it. You use 4 of the 5 senses, and you get really strong pathways. You get that information to stick. So it's multisensory, and I'm going to demonstrate that for you as well. It's sight last. And this is a major difference. How many times when you were taught spelling did you go and copy your words 5 times or 10 times each to learn the words? How many times when you go to spell a word do you have to write it several times in several different ways to figure out how it's spelled? Well, in this program, they don't see it first. They build the words sound by sound, syllable by syllable, a guided dictation. I'll show you how I do that. After writing the word in their own notebooks, by this guided dictation, they dictate it back to the teacher, and then together they analyze the word, why it's spelled the way it's spelled. So students aren't passively educated. They participate actively during the whole process. Now, finally, there are no sight words. Well, only one. The word I we teach as a sight word, and if I have time at the end, I'll show you how we do that. Mrs. Spaulding, when she taught this, she didn't believe in any frills. She didn't believe in pictures. She didn't believe in songs. She didn't believe in any of that. And songs, I can tell you, for math or for reading, are a bad idea because you retrieve information in a different part of your brain when you're singing it than when you're reciting it. So just think about that. I learned the books of the Bible by singing them. I have to sit there and hum it in my head sometimes to get to the book I'm wanting. So it's a bad idea. When you need information for instant recall, it's a bad idea to use music. Okay, so by teaching precisely how to think to spell, we have a focus on this in this program. There are no sight words. Now think about how you spell the word Wednesday. What do you think to spell Wednesday? Wednesday. Everybody came up with that. Wednesday. Do you say Wednesday? Mm-mm. No, in this program, sometimes we have to think differently to spell a word than how we actually pronounce it. And the reason for that, most words are spelled the way they're pronounced. But some words, and usually it's in a multi-syllable word where the accent is on one syllable, the vowel sound in the accented syllable is true. But in the other syllable, we tend to blur it. And that's where modern dictionaries got the schwa. Older dictionaries marked for the precise sound, but modern dictionaries throw a schwa in there because that's not how we say it. But it is, these students, it's amazing. I'll give you an example. The word human. We think to spell human. Do we say human? No, we say human. But if we don't think it accurately, we're going to get a wrong vowel sound in that second syllable. And so students are constantly taught, we think to spell this, we read this. And so they have an accurate picture in their mind of how to spell a word. The other thing it does is it eliminates accents. And I taught a class in Rhode Island once. And the phonogram AR that says R, they say as ah. They say, instead of car, they say ka. And they could do it. They would think, they would spell it out. They would say k-r, and then they would all say ka. So it really does. And Wanda Sinceri, the author, actually was raised in the South, so she has a bit of a Southern accent. I remember when she was teaching the word upon one time, I could not tell what she was saying. But it eliminates that. It makes us all the same. So it teaches accurate speech patterns. So there are no sight words. And I would, you know, I'd love to read to you some of the quotes that I'm going to read you one quote. And then I'm going to get to the meat of this. This was actually out of Samuel Blumenfeld's book, The New Illiterates. And I got a lot of my information about the history of the whole word approach to reading from him. But this is what he said, because I think sight words are dangerous. I really do. Some kids latch onto it and they never come out of it. It says, if an older child finds oral spelling, even of three-letter words, discouragingly difficult, it helps to explain to him that this is because he has not learned to think with his ears. He has been spelling and reading just with his eyes, and his ears haven't been doing their share of the work. Once his ears have learned to cooperate, they will be able to help his eyes, and this will make reading and spelling much, much easier. This probably explains why so many sight readers have such difficult reading comprehension problems. A sound symbol reader thinks with his ears and therefore more easily hooks up reading to thinking, because as we have shown, thinking is internalized speech and writing is thinking on paper. A sight reader, however, is trying to think with his eyes, which simply cannot be done. The thinking process is a direct extension of the speaking process, and you short-circuit or break up the smooth flow of the process by inserting a sight-reading technique between the written language and the thinking mind. In sight-reading, the child associates words with ideas rather than with sounds. Therefore, the process of reading and thinking is constantly interrupted by sight associations, somewhat the same as what that sentence I showed you with the symbols in it does. It slows you down. The New Illiterates by Samuel Blumenfeld. All right. Now, this is the part where I have to come down and use the board. So I hope you can see in the back. Now, I'm going to talk about this before I come down and demonstrate it. Phonograms are taught with handwriting. That's the whole tactile part of it. See it, hear it, say it, write it. And our instruction is direct. Now, I'm always surprised when schools aren't more careful about teaching their students how to form letters. We are very explicit with that. Students can come up with all sorts of interesting ways to write their letters and numbers unless you're very precise in telling them how to do it and making them practice it. Letter names are unnecessary. Now, that's going to probably surprise you. But letter names do not help us read. To know that a C says, or that a C is a C, is very different than knowing that a C says K. So in this program, we try to eliminate letter names. Now, you can't all the way. And it's surprising, even if a student, I had a daughter that I never taught the letter names to. I just taught her the sounds. And she eventually picked them up. I mean, I didn't have to directly teach those to her. But most kids come knowing their letter names. But you want them to understand that's not going to help them with spelling and reading. They need to know the sounds. And the other thing I'll show you at the end. When you're doing phonograms, it's one thing for me to flash them to you and have you tell me the sounds. It's another thing for me to tell you to use an ah, and you know which letter to use. So they have to not only be able to read the phonograms, they have to be able to spell them or write them simply from dictation. So hopefully I'll have time to do that with you. But I want to teach you. I'm just going to work with the single-letter phonograms, the first 26, and I'm going to teach them to you. Now, you have a handout for that. And it's the very front of your handout. So I'm going to have to get my handheld mic. I don't know how this is going to work, but I'm going to give it a shot. And I want you to can you hear me? Is it working? I want you to participate with me on this, so you have to do what I'm asking you to do. All right, so you'll notice on this sheet, I have organized the single letter phonograms that I'm going to teach you by stroke, by the first stroke. And the first line, we teach using a clock. We call them clock letters. And the reason we do that is because, you'll see, I'll show you how to do that. But I want to talk a little bit about the fact that we teach cursive first. Now, I don't know how many of you do that or if that's going to give anybody a heartburn, but there's all sorts of good reasons to teach cursive first. And my biggest reason for it is that you get children used to writing a manuscript. They become very automatic with it. They're in the middle of second grade, they can write a sentence, they can express themselves in words. And then about the middle of second grade, you say, okay, we're not going to use this anymore. We're going to learn something different. And then for the rest of second and third grade, they have to relearn a way to write. And a lot of them resist it. A lot of them never transfer over to cursive. And cursive is quicker, it's more natural. And you'll find, I remember having students come into my math class in seventh, eighth grade and saying to me, Mrs. Williams, do we have to write in cursive? Say yes, but they did that in 7th and 8th grade. They still were not good with cursive. Now, I'll bet many of you have a hybrid of cursive and print. I know I do. And I went to a Catholic school where they really stayed on top of you in your cursive handwriting. So, and that's my club for cursive first, but I'm going to teach it that way. It's interesting because all cursive letters start at the same place. If you write a manuscript, you have to start in, I think, 5 to 7 different places. So it makes sense. It also prevents reversals because they all start in the same place. Okay. So what I'm going to do is I'm going to teach. I don't know how this is going to work. I'm going to teach you.
Why not?
Is that on?
No.
Can you hear me with that?
Yeah, just put it down.
They want to record you. Is, and they're in the right order. The next
one is. Okay? So it makes two sounds. Now, all of our single vowel sounds have more than one sound. But there's only three consonants that have more than one sound, and this is one. So this is a short clock letter. We start at the baseline. We go up, over to the two, back around, curve up. Now write it and say it as you write it. And I promise I'm not going to do this with all 26 letters. I'm just going to do it with a few. The next one is D. Now notice I didn't say duh. I said D. So the whole idea is to isolate the sound as you would hear it in a word. Back around to the two, straight down below the baseline, loop back, and curve up. Oh, is it working? Great. Okay. Did you write it? Yeah. All right, next one is A-O-U.
A-O-U.
I have to tell you a story about this. My grandson, and this will let me get into the salt letters, because some, you can teach this to very young children. You just don't want to give them a pencil when they're too young, because they'll grip it too tight or they won't be able to grip it. Their fine motor skills aren't good enough. So you can write this in anything. And I like to fill like a jelly roll pan, not fill it. You just put a teeny bit, enough salt in it that you can write in it. And I teach my grandchildren, I started him when he was three, I teach them to write and to say the sounds. And, you know, they get some of them, they don't get, you know, it's fine because it's all introducing it to them. So my little grandson that just turned four, he went to the doctors, and he had to have his eye checked. And so they point to a star, and they say, what's this? He goes, oh, it's a star, a moon. What's this? Oh, it's a moon. They pointed to a circle. He goes, that's an A-O-U. So I'm sure the doctor didn't understand that, but it was, I thought that was really good that he remembered that that's what it was. All right, so an A-O-U. You start at the baseline, up and over to two, back around, up and a dip. All right, now this is the first two-letter phonogram that I'm going to teach you. And I haven't talked much about this yet, but we have sounds that are voiced, and we have sounds that are unvoiced. This is an unvoiced sound. This is qua. And we teach a rule with it. Now, I haven't talked too much about the rules yet, but there are 28 rules, and people think that's too many rules. But we only teach them as they're needed. So it's not like they memorize this list of 28 rules. They learn them as they're needed for the information that they're acquiring. So in this case, we teach qu. Q is always followed by U. U is not a vowel here. Say that with me. Qu. Q is always followed by U. U is not a vowel here. So this is our first two-letter phonogram. So we go up and over to two, back around, down below the baseline, loop forward, up to the midline, back down, curve up, back down, curve up. Qu. All right, now, I think I'm just going to teach you the sounds here on in. All right, so the next group of sounds are start with an uphill stroke. So the next one is I, I. I, I. So it's a short letter, with and you dot it at the end. All right, so the next one is just J. And then we have buh, buh. Now, that's not voiced. Think about what you do when you say buh and you say puh. Your lips are in the same place. You're doing the same thing with your mouth. Buh is voiced, puh is not. And we have quite a few sounds like that. All right, the next one is ruh. It's not er. People want to say er, but er spells er. If you say the word run, say the word run, and isolate what you say at the beginning. Rrr. It's almost like a growl. Rrr. Rrr. All right, next is zzz. Makes both sounds. Next is t. Next is a, u, u. Next is v. Now, we haven't gotten to that sound line yet, so I'll just keep going. All right, the next is w. And the next is y-i. Now, this is the only phonogram that can be either a consonant or a vowel. As a consonant, it says y. As a vowel, it says I or I. All right, the next group of letters has to do with loops. So the first one is e. Next is ul. Now it's not la, it's ul. Next is h. Next is k. And sometimes we say k, tall, k, to differentiate it from a C. But you really don't have to because it only makes one sound. It doesn't make two sounds like a C. Next is b. And next is f. Now notice with f and v. Same thing with your mouth. One is voiced, one is not. All right, the final group we call hump letters. And the first is n. Notice my mouth is open with n. Next is m. My mouth is closed. Next is x. And x is the one letter that you actually have to do two sounds to make the sound. You have to say k and s really quickly together to make that sound. And then the last one is z. Okay. Now, I want to quickly do this with you. Just if you can turn your paper over, I just want to dictate some of these to you so you get a feel for what it's like to have them dictated as opposed to flashing them to you. So we'll just do five, just so you get a... No, that's fine. Thank you, Dory. All right, number one, I want you to write qu, qu, and you should say it as you write it. This is the other thing. When you're teaching students, you always want them talking to themselves. Say these things to themselves. All right, number two, write s, z. You can go either way. Normally in a quiz, I would go down. After s, I want you to write a, u, u. Under a, u, u, I want you to write n. And under n, I want you to write a, a, a. When I give you vowels, it's kind of a no-brainer because the long sound of a vowel is the same as its name. But do you see how it's different when you have to write it simply from the sound as opposed to me showing it to you? All right, now, what I want to do... How am I doing time-wise? Oh, got to hurry up. Okay, so what I want to do next is I want to dictate a couple words to you, and then I'm just going to quickly show you some of the more complex rules that we teach. All right, so I'm going to use sight words. I'm going to use some sight words, or what I think is normally taught as sight words. And the first one, and the way I do this is always the way I do it with a student. I say the word, I use it in a sentence to give it a context, I say the word again. These are all going to be one-syllable words, but I have them decide how many syllables the words are because we spell by syllables. Then we talk about, together, we decide what's the first sound, and you're going to see me do this with my fingers. I'm not going to take time to explain this, but this is a real effective way to teach. But I put up a finger, and they tell me the first sound, second sound, third sound. And if I have a two-letter phonogram, I put two fingers together so that it gives them a clue. All right, so I'm going to start with the word put. I need you to put your trash in the can. Put. All right, how many syllables? We usually clap them. So they clap it, and they say one syllable. What's the first sound? We use the u, uh. What's the third sound? Now I want you to write p, t. Go ahead and write it. Good. Sound it as you write it. Now read what you've written. All right, now I want you to dictate it back to me. No? Sounds. Tell me sounds. P. Good. And in a classroom, your goal is to get them to do it all together. All right, now I'm going to start with some markings here. Normally, with a vowel, we don't mark the first sound. We assume it because that's the most common sound. I told you we have reasons for when it makes its second sound, so we don't mark the first or second sound of a vowel. But in this case, it makes the third sound. So we put a 3 above it because it's making its third sound. So that's part of the markings that I was telling you about. Now, in the end, I say to them, we review it. We think to spell p, t. We read put. Okay? So let's do another one. Let's do the word was. He was my friend. Was. How many syllables? One syllable. Now this is where I need to talk to you, because I'm going to tell you we think to spell was. We say was. All right, so we're going to think to spell was. What's the first sound? We use the a. Now, you see why I have to tell you that? We have another way to spell a. We can spell it as an O. So I have to tell you that it's an a. What's the last sound? Z. We use the s. Z. So I want you to write w, a, z. Go ahead and write it. Say it as you write it. Read it. Good. Dictate it. Okay, now we have to mark it. Any ideas how we need to mark it? We need a 3 over the A, and we need a 2 over the Z, because this is making its third sound, this is making its second sound. And that's often taught as a sight word. Oh, that's a good question. Because remember I said it's sight last. This is the first time they see it other than what they've written in their notebook. So you train them that you say, and I should have said this, does what you wrote look like what I wrote? And if it doesn't, then you wrote the wrong thing and you need to fix it. And usually when you have them fix it, you have them erase the whole thing and start over. But you want it fixed right away. That's a good question. All right, last one, and I'm going to teach you another phonogram to teach you this one, because it drives me nuts that this is a sight word. We're going to learn the word the, okay? So I need to show you this phonogram, and this is actually th. So it has an unvoiced sound, and it has a voiced sound. It has a kind of a soft sound and a hard sound, all right? So if I taught the word the, I would say now. Sometimes we say the, sometimes we say the. We're going to think to spell the. So listen to my sentence. I ate the orange after I peeled it. The. How many syllables? One syllable. The. E. Go ahead and write that. Read it. Dictate it. Okay, now, remember, no, I didn't tell you this yet. One of the markings is if you have a combination of letters that makes a sound, you underline them to show they go together. So we're going to underline the. We also need to put a 2 above it because it's making its second sound. Now I'm going to teach you a rule. And I'm going to start by asking you a question. Why does that E say E? And this is the answer. E says E at the end of a syllable. Say that. E says E at the end of a syllable. And then I'm going to ask another question. And this is a rule. Does E usually say E at the end of a syllable? And the answer is yes. And this is the rule. A, E, O, and U usually say A, E, O, and U at the end of a syllable. Okay? Now, I'm not going to make you memorize that right now. If you were in my class, I would. But so the marking for that is we underline it. Now, that's one of the ways our vowels make its long sound. Is at the end of a syllable. All right? So we think to spell th, e, we say the, and sometimes we say the. Okay? Now, I'm going to go back up here. Does this work now? Yeah. Okay. All right, so I'm going to quickly go through this because we don't have a lot of time left. All right, so now looking at this, there's a little bit of a play on words here. Do you see what I see? Okay? Oh, I remember that. All right, when you look at cat, what do you think? Do you think C-A-T? And what does that mean? Does that mean look at a t-shirt? Now, that's what I meant about letter names don't help you read that word. But if you use sounds, if you say k-a-t, you read cat. Now, can we teach just one sound per letter? A lot of programs do. And then you end up with all these sight words because they haven't given them the information. C usually does say k, like in cat, cod, clap, music. But English has more than one sound for some letters. And C can say k in cat. It can say s in scent. Now, we have a rule. Here's another rule. Why does that C say s? And the answer is this. C says s before E, I, or Y. Repeat that with me. C says s before E, I, or Y. But English has more than one way to spell some sounds. And this is where it really gets complex. How many ways do we spell k? Well, we can spell it with a C, as in cat. We can spell it with a K, as in kitten. We can spell it with a CK, and we actually call that k, two-letter k, as in back. And we can spell it with a CH, as in ache. Now, if we don't give this information to them, they're lost when they come to these words. And the thing is, we give it early, very quickly. They learn all the 70 phonograms early, so they're not left in the dark. They know what letters can say. But now look at CH. CH actually has three sounds. It can say ch in child. It can say k in chaos. And it can say sh in chef. Now this is interesting because Anglo-Saxon words, CH says ch. That's our most common way to use it. In Greek words, it says k, like in chaos or Christ or school. Those are Greek words. And French words, it says sh, like in chandelier. Now, in the National Spelling Bee, students can't ask the definition of a word, but they can ask the origin of a word. And so if they understand this, if it's a Greek word with a k sound in it, they know that sound is going to be spelled with a ch. So remember I said we teach these spelling rules as we need them. We have four rules about C. C says before E, I, or Y. So here's an example of words before E, I, or Y. Scent, city, cyst. Now, what happens when we need a hard K sound at the beginning of a word and it's followed by an E, I, or Y? We use a K. That's pretty much the only time we have K at the beginning of a word, is because there's an E, I, or Y after it. There's only one I can think of. There's probably a few more, but they're not real common words. The word I can think of is kaleidoscope. Well, and that's not really an English word, but that's one where that would be different. But most of the time, your K is going to be before an E, I, or Y at the beginning of a word. Now, what does that say? Donk or dank? Dank. Now, C usually says K, but C says before an E, I, or Y. Now, if I give that a silent E, now that C says, now most of us are taught that silent E words are to make the vowel sound long. But there are actually five different kinds of silent E's. And this is the third most common, where an E lets a C say S or a G say J, because the rule about G is very similar to E before an E, I, or Y. So we need the silent E to let the C say S. All right, now, we have a rule that silent final E words lose the need. This is the eavesdropping rule. But we put in there commonly, and I want to show you why, because this is, you probably never realize why a word is spelled this way. If we add a vowel suffix to ing, to dance, if we add ing to it, and get the word dancing, it works there because the I still lets the C say S. But C before an A says K. So what happens if we want to write danceable? Now, that's not a real common word, I realize, but it works with other ones, traceable, noticeable. We can't because it would say dankable instead of danceable. So in that case, we have to keep the E. We have a few words like that, manageable, noticeable. We have to keep the E because of its job with the letter preceding it. Now, here's an interesting thing, too. CK is only used, this is a rule, k, two-letter k is only used after a single vowel, which says a, e, I, a, a. So short vowel sounds. Now, this is probably a spelling convention because of adding vowel suffixes to this. What happens when we add vowel suffixes to a hard C? It becomes soft. So we have to keep the K in there to keep that hard sound. So that's why those words are spelled with a CK. Now, this is interesting, too. Look what happens here, backing. But what happens when we have panicking? How do we spell that? Well, we add a K to it. Picnicking is the same way. Frolicking is the same way. You have to change that spelling, or you're going to change the sound. Now, the summary of the C rule. C says before E, I, or Y. The C says because of the E, the silent E words. Silent final E words commonly lose the need for the E when adding a vowel suffix. Doesn't work with a consonant suffix, but it works with a vowel suffix. And K is only used after short vowel sounds. So let me summarize this quickly. We have a challenge before us. We have a huge language. And so how do we tackle that? We target a core set of words and words that are going to have meaning to them. We have a complex code, and so we streamline the code. We have 70 phonograms. We have 28 rules. With that information, we can teach them all of these spelling words. And finally, we have a limited capacity to memorize. There's no doubt that there's a certain amount of memory in spelling, but this gives them a way to do it. It gives them a way to analyze and remember. And so we use a multisensory approach. They see it, hear it, say it, write it. So we have 70 reliable phonograms with 28 reliable rules, and that gives us 98% of the high-frequency words, 85% of most words. And that is the end. And I guess we don't have time for questions, so if you have any questions, feel free.